Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, back this week after you've been guest hosted by my colleague Jarl Lasowski. Last week, I think Jarl did a stellar job with that epic radio voice and equipment that I'm very envious about. Please do check out Consumer Choice Radio, the CCC's North American radio program, which you can also listen to as a weekly podcast wherever you're listening to this podcast. This is the episode of July 15, 2021, in many European countries, the start of the summer holidays, so prepare for jam-packed airports as travel is resuming. I'm happy people are back on planes and trains, but frankly, if all of you could just hurry up a little bit at security check, that'd be great. Also, I guess, congratulations to Italy for winning the Football Euro Cup. Football is coming Rome this time, and apparently it's deserved. My guest this week is Lisa Katsiashvili. We know Lisa's work from the World Vapors Alliance, but that's not the reason I'm having her on this week. As you've probably seen, there are major protests happening in the Republic of Georgia, so I wanted to have her on and discuss what the protests are about and how she sees the situation. Stay tuned for that interview at the end of this episode. Also in this show, billionaires are flying to space, and the EU launches its Fit for 55 climate program. So of course I want to start off with this.
5, 3, 2, 1, release, release, release. Clean release. Ignition. Good rocket motor burn. There's Mach 1 trimming now. Trim complete. Unity is pointed directly up and heading to space. Things are looking great. We are 25 seconds into the burn now, approaching Mach 2.
This is, of course, being Richard Branson going to the edge of space with spectacular video going with it. I've read a lot of people on Twitter being annoyed with billionaires going to space. Even one tweet I've read saying that this shows the sort of decadence of the upper classes. I'm glad to see that NASA Administrator Bill Nelson sees that differently on CNBC.
Citizens would have the opportunity to do the same thing.
It was hard to believe that because it was so tough back then. We were going on machines that, for example, the space shuttle had 1,500 critical parts, any one of which failed, and that was it. It was catastrophe. But we put up Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom into suborbit 60 years ago. And now we've come to this, and I think it's great. And I think what these billionaires are doing is great. And I think what Elon Musk has done, going to orbit with astronaut crews, I think that is great.
You've seen Cape Canaveral and all of these places that we weren't sure we were going to use again. Suddenly they're in high demand. Lots of companies kind of competing to see if they can do this. What's it feel like at NASA, and what does it feel when you see those places that had kind of been shuttered before being used once again?
There's a lot of excitement, and you described it very well. The Cape was pretty well, all those launch pads, they were abandoned, and now they've come to life. And there are frequent launches from the Cape. There's an excitement there, and now on the Kennedy Space Center side, as the largest rocket, most powerful rocket ever, is being stacked in the Vehicle Assembly Building and will launch at the end of the year the Space Launch System with its spacecraft Orion. That has got an excitement around the Kennedy Space Center that you just can't believe.
Ultimately, this is a great thing for innovation that these space flights are being done. It shows the immense human ingenuity that goes into space travel, and of course people with resources will be able to fund that. Many innovators in the past were actually rich people who were able to fund this sort of research that, of course, these are projects that of course, foster their image on the world and so on and so forth. Of course, it gives them publicity. But ultimately, it's also about that these people are driven either by having a legacy, but also by fostering human innovation, which very often they have done already, which made them rich in the first place. I mean, if you look at Jeff Bezos, you can think of Amazon, whatever you'd like. But Amazon has just revolutionized the way we see e-commerce. It's made it easy, it's made it affordable, it's created incredible competition. For those who see that Amazon is a problem, it's the same kind of people that that should actually have been upset when there were only a few retailers in the business and you had to physically go in person to buy a product that was just too expensive. So I think competition in there is great, and these people are rich for a reason, because they provided great value to consumers. And I think the space flight and that space race, I much prefer that it's private. You know, the last space race we've had was one paired with significant military involvement. Whoever won the space race was then also the powerful one that might have started the war, or we had to win the space race to avoid a war. When governments were involved in these kind of things, usually it was for military purposes. Now billionaires are just trying to do it to be the first one that goes into space on their private aircraft. I think that's considerably more harmless than whatever governments were doing, with considerably more resources, by the way, and governments having considerably larger budgets. So ultimately, I think this is a good thing, and people shouldn't be so salty on Twitter. But then again, of course, Twitter is not the real world, and we shouldn't take that too much at face value. And then, of course, and this is something else that I really wanted to talk about because it's very much in the news this week, the European Union has released its Fit for 55 climate program. This is part of the European Green Deal. And the ambition to cut greenhouse gas emissions significantly from 2030, some of them by 2035, depending on the goals and the exact area that it is concerned. So there's a big package that was released this week on Wednesday. And so one that we've already talked about is the end of the combustion engine. So it seems that by 2035, that overall there will be no new combustion engines that can be purchased. So this is diesel or petrol, and it even includes hybrids. So that means that you can really only go electric, because I don't think the hydrogen car level is really just on up to speed in order to provide for that market. I think this is very problematic. I think I've talked about this on some of the past episodes. I don't think this is a good thing. Ultimately, also because the infrastructure is just not there. And if you need to go by electric vehicle to a country that is not as well equipped on the charging stations, it's not practical, and also the charging isn't quick enough unless you have one of the very expensive cars. And I think that ultimately will create more of a disparity between consumers. And then, of course, carbon pricing will be one of the topics. Carbon border mechanisms is one of the things. The carbon border mechanism basically means that if you import a product that has lower environmental standards than EU member states, then ultimately you will be taxed. So this is, of course, a tariff, and it tries basically to avoid that companies produce in countries other than those that are members of the European Union. So basically, you could produce in Belarus or Ukraine, and then you could re-import into the European Union, especially if those countries have a trade deal with the European Union. So the European Union tries to prevent countries and companies from circumventing its rules, its environmental rules. And of course, that those costs will be passed down to consumers. There again, a big injustice. Another cost that will be passed down to consumers is the upgrading of the European Trading Emissions Standard Scheme. Basically, there we've talked about this before. It's including more than just aviation in that carbon tax. Also, transport and construction will be included in that. So that will mean more taxes on you building a new house or you getting your products that have been shipped or transported by road. There again, I'm not a big fan of it, because ultimately that's a tax on consumers, especially those consumers that are on low incomes. These are regressive taxes. And then, of course, the name of the policy, which is not particularly well chosen, Fit for 55. I had this great Politico article that came out. It was headlined, "Horny for 40, Fit for 55, EU's climate plan branding raises eyebrows." Of course, Fit for 55 sounds more like a dating app profile than anything close to a policy proposal. The naming of the policies the European Commission isn't really good on. I mean, even the European Green Deal, very much copied from the Green New Deal proposal that exists in the United States. But ultimately, it's not about the naming the policy than really the policy itself and sort of what it means for consumers. And I've written about this in the past where I've said, you know, the price of the European Green Deal is something that we need to put into consideration. The European Green Deal is one of the cornerstones of the von der Leyen Commission. It's hardly controversial to say that the European policymakers have responded to public pressure with more environmentally friendly policies, which have in turn created heated debates over many other EU policies, ranging from the Common Agricultural Policy reform to the EU Mercosur Free Trade Agreement. The European Green Deal is ambitious, but is it really the right way to go? The additional expenditure of the European Union per year between 2020 and 2030 will be 260 billion euros. At the end of September, the European Commission released an impact assessment that answers the question of the other costs that will also come to consumers. This document has largely remained uncommented by the Commission itself or in the broader media landscape, which is surprising because it contains crucial data points. For once, in most models laid out in the assessment, GDP is expected to shrink. This is in close relationship with declines in employment, consumption, and exports. The latter will be particularly devastating for countries that heavily rely on export industries, which employ people with limited re-employment opportunities. As service industries, such as the financial sector, will be less affected, this will just widen the opportunity gap in the labor market. We should be transparent about the effects of the European Green Deal, especially if it implies worsened situation for consumers. Another weight on existing inequalities will be rising energy prices for consumers. The German energy shift, which is known as the Energiewende, has shown this already. A quick change to renewable energy sources arrived through subsidization programs has sharply increased consumer energy prices. The Commission's impact assessment recognizes that, though in a way that puts into question their considerations for social sustainability. A common narrative in the European Commission, then, is that these environmental policy shifts enable jobs and wealth creation. The European Green Deal Commissioner Frans Timmermans likes to talk about green jobs, referring to the opportunities created by the Commission's plans. Instead of the COVID-19 crisis giving him pause, Timmermans says that our response to the COVID-19 crisis allows us to save jobs not for years, but for decades to come, and create new jobs. We may never again spend as much to reboot our economy, and I sure hope we will never have to do it again. Will he reconsider that now that the impact assessment of his own European Commission revealed, 3 weeks after his speech, that the cost for this strategy is significant? But again, you know me, I won't be holding my breath for that. So I think the Fit for 55 policies will have to create significant questions in the European Parliament, I hope, because this means significant damage to consumers and the overall economy, and therefore we should really take a step back and reevaluate. But now, of course, let's move to the interview of this week. My guest is Liza Katsiashvili from Georgia. We know Liza's work from the World Vapors Alliance, but now we're talking about what's going on with the protest in the Republic of Georgia. So Liza, you are in Georgia, that's the republic, not the state, for those listeners who can sometimes be confusing that there's two Georgias out there. But the Georgia that we are talking about today is in quite some turmoil. There's protests going on, people seem to be mad about, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. What are people upset about in Georgia? What are these protests all about?
First of all, thank you, Bill, for giving me this opportunity to talk a little bit about what's going on in Georgia as of now. So just to give a full picture to your listener, I will try to start from the very beginning. And it's the date of 5th of July, because on 5th of July, Tbilisi Pride concluding rally was supposed to happen. The week before, they were having some different events across city, but that was just a concluding rally, and they were supposed to walk down the main avenue in Tbilisi. And the day prior to that rally, the march, they started receiving those threats, numerous threats from some extremist, ultra-nationalistic pro-Kremlin groups. And the existence of those groups is actually no big news here, because we have seen them coming out in different circumstances. For instance, there was a premiere of the first movie about the gay couple, and they came out and they tried to be very disruptive there. They beat up some of the people who went just to see the movie. They are very violent, they are encouraging, and they have this pro-Russian propaganda and agenda, and basically they claim to be defending this sort of true Georgian values, or as they like to call it. So these groups were threatening that they would come out in the streets and they would beat everyone up who, participating in Tbilisi Pride. And just we should put an emphasis on who those groups were actually targeting and who were beat up later on. But I'm just going to talk about that a bit later. Before that, I just want to tell you what was the reaction of the government, because certainly it's a legit thing to do when there are numerous threats of violence coming from the sort of groups. It's very important what the reaction of the government will be, because they should defend the constitutional rights of free speech and free assembly of whoever wants to go out in the street, basically. So our PM, Prime Minister Irak Gharibashvili, made a statement that very morning. And the only thing he actually said was that Tbilisi Pride was a provocative movement, and that the majority of Georgian population does not want it to happen. So he encouraged Tbilisi Pride either to be cancelled or to change the location. So they said nothing about guaranteeing and defending their safety and basically supporting their constitutional rights. Rather, he just told everyone that we should obey the will of majority there.
Curious there, was this the first year that Tbilisi Pride was going on? And is it the first year that it is controversial? Because this reaction by the Prime Minister, it sounds a bit like this was news and this had never happened before. Had there been previous prides?
So LGBTQ plus movement and the organizations that support Tbilisi Pride existed before. And we saw in 2013, actually the first sort of demonstration in support of this community. And it was a really big and like tragic date for Georgia as well, because many people went out in the street and they beat up a lot of people, including priests who were beating up not Pride participants back then, but participants of the demonstration. I think Tbilisi Pride as an organization exists for recent 2 or 3 years. They are always trying to hold different demonstrations and basically exercise their right to free expression. However, it's always a huge obstacle for them, because we have those groups who are quite violently trying to distract this process and be an obstacle for them. So it's not the first year. It's not the first year. However, it has always been hard for them to fulfill whatever they wanted to. So to take out on a protest or basically demonstrate.
And is there an age disconnect? Because like I've heard this a few times, Georgia and Tbilisi and specifically being sort of the Berlin of the East, like the young youth culture. Is this old people being like disagreeing with the progressive attitudes of the young, or are there also young people who support these kind of conservative movements?
Yes, that's a good question, and I would say that it's not really about the age, because I think what is happening is that those extremist groups are actually, they want to be represented as a face of the whole country. However, those are like 1,000 wild people who just go out in the street and beat up the participants of a peaceful demonstration, and the most of the population might be conservative, but on the other side, I think that we have agreed as a society that we don't want violence to be the language among each other and the communication tool. So I think those people, what those people are trying to represent, does not really represent what the majority of the population in Georgia wants. However, they really want to kind of do that. Mostly I would say young people might be supporting Tbilisi Pride. So most of the supporters of Tbilisi Pride probably are young. But however, I think violence has been condemned by not only young people, but all of the generations. Like, it has been a big mix after the violent groups basically beat up people in the streets.
What we see often with protests is that it starts on one issue, but then it continues because people are not just upset about one thing, but a wide array of issues. And from what I understand right now is that the protests aren't only about the reaction of the government in terms of the Pride attacks and the things that have been going on there. What are sort of the other issues that people are upset about?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think that's a really legit question, because that day Tbilisi Pride was actually cancelled, because Tbilisi Pride organizers, if the government said that we don't have enough human resources and we don't have enough police to defend you, they couldn't take the responsibility because they knew that some participants would be beaten up and it was really dangerous for the health of their participants and supporters, and it got cancelled. So those violent groups kept wandering around the streets of Tbilisi, and who they actually targeted were the NGOs, mostly pro-Western NGOs or NGOs that oppose the actions of the government quite loudly. They also targeted journalists. So 53 journalists all in all were beaten up deliberately. They were acting in quite organized manner. For instance, they were beating up cameramen in their face, and they were also damaging their equipment so that they could not actually take what was going on and could not show us what was going on, right? So, and they also, one symbolic act that they did was that they burnt down EU flag 2 times, which was in front of Georgian Parliament. So they're, like, these are the groups that are targeted by these extremists, and for them, these groups are representing the same evil. For them, it's like a liberal democracy, westernization of Georgia. This is what they are in reality opposing, and that's why we say that they are pro-Kremlin, pro-Putinist groups, because Georgia has only 2 ways out of which it can choose. It either joins the West and commits to European values, or it stays in the hands of Putin, which I think my generation and most of the people here do not want to see.
So the anticipation from the government is, of course, to protect minority groups and individual rights, and many of the you say this is a small group of people, but it seems to wage large amount of power if they are able to get events like this cancelled. What do you expect? What are sort of the short term things that you think that these protests could pressure the government of changing their minds and being better?
Before telling you that, I just want to specify one more thing, that 5 days after the incident that journalists were beaten up and the extremist groups stormed the offices of different organizations, 5 days after all these events, the cameraman who was beaten up by 20 people and who was left alone with only one policeman in the office, and that was the main thing. They did not let enough police in the streets so that they could not defend journalists, they could not defend media, they could not defend different organizations. And this cameraman, his name was Alexander Leshkarawa, he very tragically passed away, and we heard about that on 11th of July in the morning. And obviously the first thing that you think is that this is because he got very severe injuries, because his facial bones were broken, he had brain concussion, he had to go under operation. And the first thing that civil society does after that, obviously, is that they go out in the streets and they protest. And we all demanded the resignation of Prime Minister Irakli Garibashvili, because he basically gave a green light to those violent groups to go and act as they would wish. And also, we were demanding punish all the people who were actually violent and who were encouraging towards violence and who were leading those groups. So this protest was quite big. Thousands of participants were there in the streets in solidarity with everyone who got injured, in solidarity with Lashkarava. And these were the demands. The main demand is the resignation of Prime Minister and also the punishment of all the people who were involved in this violence. Now, what will it change is a different subject, because Georgia is ruled by an informal oligarch, Bidzina Ivanishvili, and basically all these people are his people, so he can change the faces, but the reality does not change that this country is ruled by him. However, it will be a gesture and a symbol, and someone should take a political responsibility, in my opinion. So that's why it is important that Irakli Gharibashvili resigns. But instead of resigning, he, of course, the next day made another statement that the majority of this country does not want Velisipay to happen. He neglects constitutional rights very openly, and he blames everything on opposition, which is a very common method for Georgian Dream. When anything bad happens, when there is a crisis, they blame everything on other parties.
And is there a strong opposition leader that could challenge the current government at an upcoming election? Is there a person that you say, well, this person could actually make fundamental changes and that has support by people, including protesters?
We have several political parties who are united in the fights against Georgian Dream and the ruling party, because they are leaning towards totalitarianism, I would already say. I think the main and important thing here is that we should come up with a system where Georgia does not depend on one leader and one person anymore, because this is what we have been doing after the collapse of Soviet Union. We did not manage to build strong institutions. We didn't manage to build a system which would bring peace and liberty to this country. People just have been following individuals, and this is power-hungry individuals, and this is what happens when we are only dependent on one person, for instance, rather than the values that we want to bring in this country. So I think opposition has a chance to improve the situation in Georgia, because in accordance with the latest agreement that was that is between the Georgian Dream and the opposition, and it was proposed by Charles Michel, we have another round of elections, self-government elections in October. So if the Georgian Dream takes less than 43% in those elections, then early parliamentary elections will be called in 2022. We should have a proportional system by then. So that's when the real chance for Georgian opposition will be, and we should have a pluralism in our parliament if we want to achieve something, and not basically one party parliament where they act as they please and they rule this country. So this is where I see the chance for the situation in Georgia to get better.
So Lisa, we're coming to the end of this segment, but I want to allow you to end on an optimistic note. I know that it is complicated, because I mean, Georgia is surrounded by other regions and countries that have all types of problems. You know, Chechnya is not too far, and then Russia is a neighbor, Armenia and Azerbaijan, Turkey, all countries embroiled in individual different conflicts and all having their own rule of law and fundamental rights challenges. But simultaneously, Georgia is also a promising tourist destination and a lot of ambitious young people. So, I mean, it's hard to formulate this entirely into a question, but I just want to know from you, I hope you're not giving up on your optimism for the future, that more is possible in this young and very promising economy and country. How do you see a Georgia in the future? Is there more to do? Is there hope?
Thanks for asking that. I think we are always protesting something here. So it's a very common thing to have those issues and to protest. And to be honest, after every protest, there might be a slight wave of nihilism that, oh, we have been there so many times, why isn't the situation improving? However, I think that, of course, the victory of true liberal values is not guaranteed here. It's not guaranteed. It's very fragile. Freedom is very fragile. But I think my generation and people around me, we understand how fragile actually is and how important it is to tirelessly stand every time there is something happening in the streets and raise our voices. I think we should come up with more effective ways to peaceful demonstration, to peaceful protests, to against all of these injustices that are happening here. I think it is already a war between the values, and what gives me hope is that our generation now knows what their values are, and also 80% of Georgian population in accordance with the latest research wants to be a member of European family. So this is the will of Georgian population, and I think we should fight it till the end until we achieve it. And I really hope that people will stand for that, because and they won't allow some small but power hungry and now powerful groups to take this country back to Russia and to Putin's hands. That's my probably biggest hope.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Lisa on Twitter at Liz Kacershvili. And of course, I highly recommend you visit Georgia, which is a wonderful tourist destination and nature undeterred by the politics of the day. As always, I'm your host, Bill Woods. See you Thursday. You have to learn.